One of the most anticipated moments at ASCO was Aimery de Grammont's presentation of the most recent findings from the MOSAIC trial comparing Fulfox to 5-FU, and in a previous issue of this series, Dr. de Grammont noted that benefits were seen in stage 3 and higher-risk stage 2 patients. When I raised this topic to the think tank group, it was like throwing raw meat into a ring of tigers, and Dr. Haller took the first bite.
Can I ask one question first about the MOSAIC trial?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I'd like to know about, were the subset analysis pre-planned?
No.
And that's part of the reason you didn't put p-values.
No.
Yeah, so it was an unplanned subset analysis for stage 2.
Stage 2 and stage 3 was planned, but not high risk.
Right,
that was
right.
not planned.
Not high risk, and it was a secondary analysis.
Right.
So quite frankly, I was a little bit perturbed
with
the presentation, which really emphasized the subsets, ascribed p-values to the subsets.
Right.
I mean, the one justification for ascribing the p-value to the stage 3s is that post hoc, the FDA did their own unplanned subset and limited the indication to stage 3s. So I find this kind of exercise, first of all, the overall, this was supposed to be an update with the first survival data presentation, which technically did not reach statistical significance. First, he presented the subset, but the overall intent to treat was 0.057 or something like
When
that.
When I heard the presentation, it was like a sucker punch.
Yeah,
the feeling
I
had in my stomach after I was watching it, and then all of a sudden, it almost went over the overall survival and the intent to treat population.
I had the same reaction that you did, Dan.
Ugh.
I must admit, I had the same reaction that you did.
And Axel, my take was that part of that was that the prior presentation that came out of the ACCENT database looking at time to recurrence change people's perception about when you need to look at survival and then maybe you need to look at it at 7 or 8 years.
I think the ACCENT database analysis and MOSAIC actually play very nicely together. And we haven't talked about one of the most intriguing presentations, which was Mike O'Connell's presentation, and especially the idea that even in the recurrent metastatic setting, there is still a major difference, apparently, in outcome for initially stage 2 or stage 3 patients, with all the problems in classifying stage 2 and stage 3, numbers of lymph nodes, and all these things. But there was
Can you kind of go back through for the listening audience what Mike presented, also what Dan Sargent presented from ACCENT?
So ACCENT is a kind of database collection based on individual patient data from about 21,000 patients treated with adjuvant therapy over the last two or three decades, dating back to the 1970s even, and going recently to the QUASAR data from the UK. And so this large database, of course, allows now to see what happens in terms of tumor recurrence, treatment effects over a large period of time. So Dan Sargent presented one of the key analyses is how do hazard ratios in terms of recurrence pattern change over time in the initial phase when chemotherapy is being conducted and the several years afterwards and long term, where competing reasons for survival, for death take over. So bottom line in Dan's presentation is number one, that the risk of recurrence, as we all know, is highest in the first 2 or 3 years, and that's where we see the majority of the effect of the adjuvant chemotherapy. But this effect lasts longer than just the treatment duration beyond the first 3 years, which indicates that we're actually curing patients with adjuvant chemotherapy, not just delaying recurrence, which I think is a very important factor. Then Mike O'Connell looked at kind of historic prognostic data for the outcome of patients that have recurrent metastatic disease. And again, one of the most intriguing findings that I thought came out of ASCO this year in the early stage setting was there is apparently a biologic difference between stage 2 and stage 3 patients, diseases that translates over into the metastatic setting when patients recur. So they analyzed patients who had recurrent metastatic disease and went back to the point, how did these patients present in the earlier stages when they were treated with adjuvant chemotherapy for stage 2 or stage 3 disease? And at the time of metastasis, at the time of tumor recurrence, when the patient were in a palliative situation, it made a big difference whether they were initially diagnosed, potentially several years ago, as stage 2 or stage 3. Stage 2 patients did remarkably better than stage 3 patients. And this again shows that the initial stage of diagnosis also tells us a little bit about the biology of a tumor in general, which translates into its behavior when tumors recur. And I think it's mandatory detour right now to translate this information in the interpretation of adjuvant trials as we're ongoing right now, because we really need to distinguish between stage two and stage three. I'm sorry.
Norm, do you agree with that? I mean, we've had this concept of relative risk reduction. It comes out of breast cancer. You look at the risk, and there shouldn't be any kind of artificial or separation between stage two and three. Now, this presentation questions that.
I'm not sure that that's relevant relative to whether to treat or not to treat a patient in the adjuvant setting with stage two disease when they have an absolute benefit relative to survival of 3% and so on. I mean, what it shows is that those individuals whose tumors recur can have a longer time to progression, that if they're stage two compared to stage three. So you can argue, well, that shows that they're biologically different, perhaps. I'm sure it does show that they have a different pattern relative to advanced disease. We knew that to a certain extent in hepatic restricted disease, that stage two patients with hepatic metastasis did better than stage three patients matched for the number of mets and so on and so forth. Probably the doubling time and the aggressiveness of the tumor is perhaps somewhat different. Again, I don't think that can be transposed back to the situation as to whether to offer or not offer chemotherapy to a stage two patient in the adjuvant setting.
Do you agree with that, Axel?
It's a different issue whether you talk about synchronous metastasis, you know, when you present liver metastasis in the context of lymph node positive disease or not, or in the context of patients who recur after several years, and you kind of predate more or less.
No, even metachronous, stage two and three are different.
Does that data change the way you approach stage two patients in terms of whether to give adjuvant therapy or not, Axel?
In the context of the MOSAIC trial, which exactly was a punch in my belly when I saw it in terms of the effect on stage two disease, it will change my standard of care in so far that I would be more hesitant than before to offer any kind of chemotherapy in stage two patients if they don't have any risk factors. If you look at the group of stage two patients unselected, there's no difference between 5-fluorovorin and 4-FOX. So high-risk patients, which made 60% of patients, saw some benefit. We never looked at the low-risk population group, and so it could actually be that 4-FOX has a tendency to harm patients with stage 2 with low-risk stage 2 disease.
He did show the low-risk data, and the hazard was higher with 4-FOX with the low risk.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, but I mean,
even worse.
You know,
it's not statistical. It's a small test.
We're making it into a circus.
Three-quarters of them were high-risk. They were almost all high risk, so you really shouldn't make
60%.
Yeah, exactly.
You shouldn't make, and it was 300 out of 480.
This is very disconcerting. I think Axel's point taken to the next level is that we really do need better criteria to define risk, both in stage 2 and stage 3.
Right.
I think the Oncotype DX is moving along very well for stage 2s. I think rather than, you know, having these nebulous criteria for what represents high risk and low risk, and going on various web pages, that we really ought to have a well-defined genetic profile. Right now, we've identified approximately 40 genes that have really, you know, a robust and constant association with outcome. I think we're going to see an Oncotype DX in colon cancer.
Let's just talk about today, though, and I want you to make your comment, Neil. But before you make your comment, a patient who doesn't have any high-risk factors of stage 2 says to you, whatever my risk of relapse is, will it decrease if I take adjuvant therapy?
I think with stage 2, I would have the conversation that if there is a benefit to treatment of stage 2, it's just a few percent with any therapy. And we're sort of revisiting the ASCO guidelines from before oxaliplatin. We're basically where we were. And the comment I wanted to make is that it's interesting to hear you guys talk about getting punched in the gut, because 2 years ago, when we were having this discussion at this group, there were people around the table saying, when I make the decision to give adjuvant therapy to a patient with stage 2, I believe you should give the best therapy. Once you make the decision to treat, give the best therapy. And now there's vindication to the notion that one should be doing clinical trials that are randomized to actually answer questions like this. And so this validates the importance of doing
clinical
trials. Well,
we need a large stage 2 trial. It's like the breast cancer population took them a decade longer to show that it adjuvant therapy worked for the node negative, but we've never gotten our stuff together to do a large randomized.
Well, we have the point 5202. Is,
well, we haven't finished 5202 yet, and the accrual's just trickling in.
The point is that what these data in several hundred patients are telling us is that we would need to do a 50,000 patient study to show a difference in survival that is modest in patients with stage 2 disease. Is that really what our goal should be?
Dan?
2 points. The gut punch for me was not in my feelings about how the data turned out. It was the audacity of the presentation. But the second point is, in the position of agreeing with Norman, is that we need to not think of the disease as stage 2 or 3. We have in our hands right now the ability to know who the good players are. So if you look at the NCD database, I was surprised that the data was shown earlier because Rick Green published that data 5-6 years ago on this. If a patient has one of 35 nodes, you know, if someone is very vigorous at node gathering and finding, one of 35 nodes has an 87% 5-year survival with surgery alone, 87%. So would I give that patient FOLFOX just because they're nominally stage 3? I would not. Because if you look at any comorbidity and you have a hazard ratio of 0.8 across the board, your likelihood of getting more than a 1% difference. The problem is your benefits are in a continuum, but your toxicities are straight line. So the person who gets 1% benefit or a 30% benefit all have the same morbidity and toxicity from their therapy. So if you know a good stage 2 patient, 35 negative nodes, good histology, no perforations, I wouldn't treat that person with 5-FU. And I think you'd be totally justified.
The other thing we didn't show from that poster, though, was when we asked oncologists about that scenario, 10% is the number we used. They're very likely to treat a breast cancer patient with 10% right. risk of relapse. And just like you said, very unlikely to treat a colon cancer patient. And I'm not sure the numbers are that dramatically different.
They're not.
Norm?
They're not different at all. I think the heterogeneity lies in this group around the table rather than in the tumor or the statistics.
But when you consider that in almost any good clinical trial, the mortality from treatment is either 0.8 to 1.2%.
Well, but the culture...
So you're going to take a 1% chance of dying versus a 1% chance of recurrence?
This happens every day in breast cancer. So my question is...
That doesn't make it right.
Exactly. I want to get both perspectives out there. What is the correct approach? But the culture in breast cancer has been to discuss it with the patient. If the patient, and actually Sobrero came up to me at the poster, his initial thought was, oh, well, all my patients want me to decide what to do. And I said, are you sure?
Did you ask them?
I said, do you want me to survey your patients just to be sure?
Good.
And you know, he kind of thought about that overnight. So the culture in breast cancer, Dan, has been if the patient wants to get involved, lay it out for them. And if they want to be treated, treat them.
But how you discuss it with them, Dan Sargent wrote this
Absolutely.
Paper, is how you discuss it with them when you only use hazard ratios and say, I'm going to reduce the chance of your tumor by 20%, more people will take it. If you use absolutes, the number drops radically. So the reality is
well,
you have to get
and for example, if you remember in
pretty sophisticated risk-benefit analysis.
In the survey that we gave to the patients, we had a stick
you
figure with
absolutes.
100 people on it. We showed one right. person's going to have a difference
right.
in outcome.
They did it right.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's
and you know, and oncologists aren't doing that
But you
anymore.
Don't know what's going on in the average office.
Well, you know what? I think in the average office, there's a lot more discussion of absolute benefits now than there was 5 years ago mm-hmm. because people are using adjuvant. Bob?
Neil, I just wanted to make a point about the way you posed the question is, should adjuvant therapy be discussed more for stage 2 as opposed to should it be offered more? I do have a sense in the community, it's a decision a lot of times the doctor makes. And frankly, I think a lot of these adjuvant discussions occur while the patient's still in the hospital, on their PCA or with an NG tube, comes around and says, well, we can do this or not. And when I have patients who've relapsed, having had a conversation about adjuvant therapy for stage 2, a lot of times you say, did you have a discussion with your physician about this in the first place? A lot of my patients say, I don't remember one. This one guy came around while I was still in the hospital, and I never saw him again. And so I think that the issue is, in terms of the choices, you're going to have a whole spectrum around this room about who leans towards adjuvant therapy, who doesn't. I think, though, in the community, as George Fisher put on one of your tapes, Those are the patients you put at the end of the day because you know if you do it right, it's going to take some time to go through the pros and cons of all this. And I think it would be nice to have a sense in the community this is really something that doctors are going through in some detail as opposed to no or yeah. And it's not really discussed. It's sort of I'm telling you what we're going to do.
Neil, one of the sentiments you hear a lot from oncologists, and I'm curious what your thoughts are, is the fact that a lot of patients, not all, but a lot, and maybe this is why we're seeing this 1% thing, quote, don't want to leave a stone unturned. They have a family to support, et cetera. They want to feel in their heart, even if it's 1%, they've done everything. Do you think that that's a legitimate kind of logic or maybe, you know, sort of a unrealistic fear that's being driven? Or is this a rational way to think this thing through?
So a good decision is one that is based on knowledge of the facts and a weighing of the facts and is rational. And what's rational, I think, is different for different people. So I think it would be presumptuous to say that would not be a rational approach. There was a study published more than 10 years ago in which breast cancer patients were asked a scenario about a trade-off with regard to adjuvant therapy for breast cancer versus toxicity. So benefits and risks of adjuvant therapy. And I don't recall whether this was actual breast cancer patients or individuals projecting themselves as patients. The bottom line was that those women who had a family were more likely to accept hazards for less benefit. And so the social support issue is a real practical issue that plays a role in how cancer patients weigh risks and benefits. And I think it's perfectly reasonable.
I'll tell you somebody else I asked this question to and that you might find interesting, which is Dan Sargent. And Dan, I interviewed at ASCO and told me, for the record, for this program, about the fact that he'd had Hodgkin's disease when he was 11 years old. And he got both radiation therapy and chemotherapy. And I said, what do you think about this 1% thing? And he said, well, you know, if I were single, no way I would do it. But I've got a couple kids, I'm a 1%er.
So the other part of it is just our social structure. One of the things you hear all the time is that, wasn't it great? This person fought. He kept on fighting and kept on going regardless. And to me, that doesn't make any sense. People are taught and they're told that you're a good guy if you have done everything you possibly could or you think you've done everything you possibly could, even if it's bad for you. Maybe it's the Western shoot 'em up phenomenon or something, but I don't think that same culture exists in many other parts of the world.
The Mosaic and Accent presentations from ASCO added more fuel to the Stage 2 adjuvant debate. And to see where they stand on this important issue, I asked Dr. Wolf about which patient subsets with Stage 2 disease he believes should at least hear the options from a medical oncologist.
The short answer is to cover your butt, I would refer them all.
Yeah.
We want to be thinking surgeons, not just acting surgeons.
I think certainly what we would consider high-risk patients, certainly those patients who, for whatever reason, had an inadequate lymph node assessment should be referred on.
Normal risks? Should they be sent?
I think they should be. I think the people you might exclude are patients who are frail, patients who had a lot of postoperative complications. What was interesting at ASCO this year is it doesn't seem, at least if we use 70 days as the cutoff for the initiation of adjuvant therapy, that there was a difference in outcome. And that is something that really hasn't been addressed in a prospective way in terms of how long after surgery will adjuvant therapy still benefit you. But I think otherwise healthy patients who certainly you feel, knowing what chemotherapy does to people, should at least be considered for it. High-risk patients, inadequate lymph node sampling.
So from the routine pathology report, I'm currently sending patients to your department who have lymphovascular invasion, assuming they have an adequate lymph node dissection, which fortunately we've had lately. Patients who have lymphovascular invasion, signet ring cell, poor differentiation, and of course these are all node negative. And those are about the only patients I'm sending your way. Now, am I missing something?
You're hearing the data present. You know the data. We've gotten into sort of how people look at these things. So you tell me, what do you think? Do you think that everybody with stage two should at least find out what the numbers are?
I guess the question is, are you having the discussion? If the answer is, I'm not discussing, I'm just not sending, that to me is different than I'm discussing.
He says, I got it all. That's what he does.
In the data that I showed, these were not a high-risk stage two population.
So you've heard the data, Lee, you know about kind of these perspectives. Your colleagues here say that they'd be treated for, you know, a couple percent, a few percent improvement in survival. Obviously,
absolutely,
a lot of pain. So why wouldn't you have that
and
discussion?
Recall
with them?
This incremental benefit for OXA was on top of an FU leucovorin.
Right.
Right.
And I'm not talking about whether they should be treated. It's just whether they should go through the discussion, which most surgeons are not going to get into that kind of detail.
So it depends on the patient. There are a lot of patients who, I tell them up front, chemotherapy will depend on your pathology report, which comes out a week later. And most of my patients are not looking for chemotherapy. They're almost looking for an excuse not to get chemotherapy. So I selectively send them. For those who are looking for chemotherapy, regardless of the pathology report, I will want Bob or one of his colleagues to evaluate them. For those patients who have an adequate node dissection, who don't have any poor prognostic factors, as I just stated, I won't send them.
What about capecitabine? And this was brought up.
Are you referring them for the trial?
Yeah, what about the 5202 trial? Is that open
please
at your place?
Do.
It is. But for high risk,
it's open for everybody.
We're not routinely doing those markers on those patients. That's right.
And what about capecitabine? We talked about chemotherapy and their concerns about it, but what about capecitabine? Herb, what's your answer to this question?
Yeah, I actually would recommend referral for most patients. From your statement before, if they were well enough to undergo surgery, they're well enough to undergo a discussion about the specifics of the risks and benefits of chemotherapy and how those risks can be modified or dealt with during treatment.
But it takes a lot less cerebration to decide whether to be operated on.
That's my point, that you can have that kind of detailed discussion, but I think given these nuances, the decision of what's right for the patient will often turn upon the risk-benefit, often around modest side effect differences, minor survival differences. And the other issue is you want the patient and their family to be there at the time they're all recuperated from surgery, much like sort of the parity discussion of, you know, if you ask the patient very soon after surgery before they've recuperated, do you want anything else now, sir? And it's like, not now. But at 2 months post-op with family present, The answer may not be exactly the same as the off-the-cuff answer in the hospital bed.
And what about the issue of capecitabine? I think it was you, Axel, who brought that up in the chat room, because that's a very different issue in terms of what people are going to be facing than FOLFOX. And again, Lee, from your perspective, I mean, is that out on your radar that this may be a possibility? And what about the issue of toning down therapy in the more borderline situations?
Capecitabine is chemotherapy, and of course the toxicity profile, as you all have taught me, is a little bit different, but it's toxicity. And as I keep seeing the data come up, there's a lack of benefit, and chemo light is going to even give you less benefit or no benefit. So I'm not really, in the absence of any reason that I would think a patient is at high risk, I have not seen any data today to support giving adjuvant chemotherapy for that patient with good prognostic factors with stage 2 colon cancer.
Any role of capecitabine or 5-FU in the lower risk, more border? I mean, breast cancer, we do this all the time. We don't use taxanes in lower risk. Jordan?
So, one, capecitabine, there's a mythology about it. It's not chemo light. It's chemo hard. LVFU2 or modified LVFU2 is so much more tolerable and cheaper than capecitabine. Two, I think that there needs to be discussion with all patients. And while I know, Lee, you're a thoughtful surgeon, not every surgeon is doing that. I still get patients referred to me with the "you've got 6 months left to live" line on a regular basis. And three, the discussion goes beyond the adjuvant therapy. Even if they are people who are selected or select not to get adjuvant therapy, there is the issue of follow-up. And there are guidelines and there are reasons to follow, and you have to have a system by following. I believe in follow-up and, you know, most importantly, the colonoscopies and the CEAs and the scans per guidelines. I think that those things are reasons why you would still refer. And, of course, right now in the era of ECOG 5202, it's crucial that we see the patients and we put them on the study.
Norm? I completely agree. I think that regardless of the decision about adjuvant therapy or no adjuvant therapy in stage twos, the role of the medical oncologist is paramount. One, for follow-up, as you say, and invariably, patients will learn infinitely more about their disease from the medical oncologist than they will from their surgeon.
Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think that even in the average risk stage two patient, there's a discussion that needs to take place, mm-hmm. and the possibility of offering adjuvant therapy has to be on the table. Now, what we've seen from the follow-up data from the Mosaic study is that in that setting, it should probably be just the fluoropyrimidine alone. And if you're choosing a fluoropyrimidine alone for adjuvant therapy, capecitabine is a perfectly acceptable option. So capecitabine does become a discussion point for many patients with stage 2 colon cancer.
Let's go back to a real low-tech way of polling. I'm going to do a show of hands. You have stage 2 colon cancer with no high-risk factors, adequate number of lymph nodes. Do you want no adjuvant chemo? Do you want FOLFOX? Or do you want 5-FU or capecitabine fluoropyrimidine monotherapy?
How many lymph nodes?
25 lymph nodes are negative.
All negative.
All negative. 25. Okay. How many of you would not want to be treated? Okay, so almost everybody.
How about 12 lymph nodes?
Couple of,
make it 12 lymph nodes.
Let's make it solid.
What is the requisite 12?
All right, 12. Let's make it 12 lymph nodes. 12 lymph nodes. How many of you would not want to be treated? Okay, so a little about half the group.
10 lymph nodes.
How many of you would want a how would you like a fluoropyrimidine monotherapy? FOLFOX?
Okay. Well, no, I would take the FOLFOX were I not a surgeon. I mean,
well, that's a good point.
No, I mean, I will go into the operating room.
That's right. Interesting. Yeah, that's a good
surgeon?
Point.
I mean, you have to.
So the neuropathy is more of a concern.
Yeah, the neuropathy becomes a concern.
Just two quickies. I asked Norman the question about the proportion of stage 2s on CO8, which was 30% vis-a-vis.
Well, I'm sorry, on CO8. CO7.
CO8.
That you asked. Now, CO8's about 25%.
So what's happened is it's gone from 40% in CO6 to down and down.
Docs
in the community are saying, you know, when they put patients on, if you have a stage 2 disease, I'm probably not going to put you on a study where you're going to get oxalate, you know, Roswell Park plus
just
oxalate.
Just Herb's under the table
Bev.
Doing things to me. Just keep that thought.
Got a picture of this over here. Where's the photographer when you need her?
It's recorded for posterity.
But is that about the Bev in the study?
It's either the oxalate
probably the
or
oxalate.
The Bev.
Okay.
The last quickie.
Okay, sure.
A quickie is that the dreaded cross-trial comparison. If you look at the Mosaic data and the CO7 data, the results look remarkably similar.
Yes.
And I personally, in a practice mode, use that as a comfort zone when I'm giving someone FOLFOX, is to say 765
right.
versus 1020.
Right.
If I at least get over the hurdle of 765, we're done. And yep. Which leads to, should we be doing studies of 6 versus 12 cycles?
On average, Dan, how far do people get with FOLFOX in your practice?
In my practice, probably about, the average number of cycles is probably 9 with oxaliplatin, and then they just continue with LV5-FU2. And that's similar to the study. But I'm 9 versus, I think Amory got in 10, but I don't like 13% grade 3 neuropathy.
I believe that we've seen an estimate of 11 out of onks in practice. I'll check. I think we have that here. Maybe we can check and see.
I think they're being too nice.
Our cumulative or maybe they're being about 70%.
So on average, Rich, how many cycles do you get?
I would say 8 or 9.
The next topic discussed by the think tank group was the highly provocative data that recently emerged from CALGB trial 89803, which was initially designed to evaluate IFL in the adjuvant setting. And while this intervention proved ineffective, prospectively obtained data from this study have demonstrated a markedly lower relapse rate in patients who exercise moderately and those who ate a prudent diet emphasizing vegetables and low-fat intake. Dr. Charlie Fuchs was an author on this historic work, along with Dr. Jeff Meyerhart. Dr. Berlin began the discussion.
The whole dietary physical exercise counseling thing, part of the reason why I said that it should be done, patients should get this, and we should be doing this, is not only the cancer, but remember, these people are theoretically going to live. 70-80% of them are going to survive their cancer, and they're fat and sitting on their butts, and they're getting unhealthier and unhealthier from other things. They're going to die from other things. I mean, it's just like the whole thing about seeing your primary care physician. Two things he can do for you, they'll save your life, will be getting you to wear a seatbelt and stop smoking.
If we had this type of data for a drug, an agent, would we be studying it now in a prospective study,
sure.
Rich?
Of course we would.
Yeah. Well, so what do you think? Should we just stick with the intergroup study, or should we think about something like this? What are your thoughts?
Well, I would like to know the answer to the intergroup study, and we've all got a big investment in that. I wrote the study
in a previous iteration, so I'm anxious to see it come to fruition. But I don't see what the obvious next study is. It doesn't seem like panitumumab is going to get out there.
No, I don't believe so.
Based on the experience I've had with 80405, trying to convince people to take 6 months of five drugs is not going to be a very effective strategy because they get beat up by the five-drug regimen. And it isn't clear to me that there's any next contender for adjuvant therapy on the horizon. So this is a good window of time to do some out-of-the-box studies like this.
When do you think that you'll be finished accrual?
About 18 years.
Months.
18 months from now. So
if we started tomorrow, we'd still have a gap.
Yeah.
So, Norm, what are the discussions? I know prior to PACE, the discussion was FOLFOX-BEV plus or minus either panitumumab or cetuximab. Where are we right now with C11, and what do you think about this idea?
I think it's certainly an idea worth exploring. It's a matter of, you know, the devil's always in the details.
So I'm just kind of curious, how much money would it take to do that trial?
Which one?
Adjuvant trial, diet and exercise through the internet. What would it cost?
Like FOLFOX plus minus
exercise
diet? You
mean compared to cetuximab?
Dealer's choice. Yeah. No. Dealer's choice, chemo, plus or minus diet or exercise. What would it cost? Neil?
Well, it depends what the intervention is.
Yeah, exactly.
There are many types of interventions geared towards behavior change. So, for example, we're currently involved in a study where we're trying to improve compliance with recommendations for colonoscopy. And this is being spearheaded by a colleague of mine, Sharon Manny. And this is a tailored intervention that is based upon patients' responses to a survey that elicit what their particular barriers to colonoscopy are. They then get a tailored phone and print evaluation and recommendation with regard to colonoscopy. With regard to diet and exercise, there are a number of different methods that have been used and that are being studied now to try and affect behavior change. And even with the use of the internet, there's a whole landscape of complexity that could be brought to bear. And it's not quite clear just yet which is the most effective in terms of diet and exercise. Actually, they're undergoing study. I'm currently mentoring a postdoc who has a Lance Armstrong Award to develop a web-based method for promoting exercise and dietary change in people with colon cancer. So I think, and to get back to your question in terms of cost, it depends on what you want to do and how aggressive you want to be in making sure the intervention has the desired effect.
Dan and then Axel.
Yeah, two quick points. One is, I think a five-drug combination, as you were alluding to earlier, could be the first time that adjuvant chemotherapy got worse. Because as the toxicities of the biologics mount and you can't give your chemotherapy on time, you could be in real trouble. Second comment about the cost. When I was chair of the GI committee in ECOG, we're going to mount an intervention trial and use fiber. So people were going to be randomized to fiber or not. And so we went through real life analysis and, you know, things on compliance. Selected patients would be asked at random, you know, like drug testing, to send a paint can full of poop to Madison, Wisconsin. A wonderful thought. And so there was a compliance factor. When we looked at the numbers, looked at even the simplest form of measurement, we were up to about $40 to $50 million in 1986. In 1986.
That's a minimum.
So the internet would not have resolved almost any of the issues that you're speaking of. And what I'm talking about is a true intervention trial with compliance checking that would move you far enough away from what you're reporting, where people are saying, you know, this is retrospective, this is da-da-da-da. So this is a true intervention trial.
Norm, can I get back to C11, though, and the issue about adding in cetuximab or panitumumab? What are your thoughts about it? Rich brought up the question about toxicity, but also there's a question of efficacy in the PACE trial. We haven't really talked about that today.
I think the PACE trial didn't do wonders for raising enthusiasm for using biologic doublets. On the other hand, I don't think it's fair to paint the entire spectrum with the same brush. I'd like some data other than the fact that it's hard to accrue and that the toxicity is not insignificant using the doublet. I still think that's an area that we would like to pursue. I think that the diet study should be done as a factorial trial because then you get the cost picked up by those individuals who have indications as their primary focus. And basically, you can append that to a template, and it won't cost you a great deal as far as sample size increase, depending on what your calculated benefit is of diet.
So what's the template?
You could do Bev versus Bev plus cetuximab plus or minus diet, just to throw out one iteration.
So basically the C11 idea.
The C11 with a diet
and use a diet as a 2x2.
Yeah.
Mm. Axel?
I think we should use this idea of diet, internet education intervention as a tag on to perhaps all future ongoing trials. It really doesn't matter what kind of background you have in terms of chemotherapy. You can make it very cheap if you just tag it along. Even the ongoing N0147 trial, it's not a randomization against diet or cetuximab, but see the influence prospectively, not in retrospective analysis, what you're doing on educating patients on outcome.
What fraction of accrual is already done right now?
It's 40%.
It's 40. 30, for the whole.
So probably by the time the thing got amended, it'd be done?
Right.
You've got to also have an intervention that's been proven to work
before
you layer it onto another study.
I think that to do the diet lifestyle, the devil's in the details. You have to figure out, you know, I think the WIN study, which is more intensive, was able to get good compliance and to maintain that intervention, that dietary intervention, for 5 years.
But it was 8 visits with a dietitian.
Right. Yeah, I think it's very doable. But when I hear things like a web-based intervention, I do worry that, you know, it might work at any of our institutions where we have highly motivated individuals.
Right.
But now we're talking about an intergroup study where, in fact, I think you've got to revisit the success of the WIN study, at least in the regard of compliance with the intervention.
Although what's been talked about is to bring phone into it to make it more, you know, personal. Yeah. Dan and then Jordan?
Yeah, I'm not going to be facetious here, but I'm going to try to, this is like a fantasy. We have the intergroup. We also have the coalition, and you can read Peter O'Dwyer's piece in the JCO on this, is the government is never going to come up with the money to do this, ever. The cooperative groups can access the patients. Is there, for example, a Jenny Craig Foundation?
Absolutely.
Is there a Weight Watchers Foundation?
Absolutely.
Where are the
advocates?
If the advocates beat at the door and said, you're really interested in non-chemotherapy things that aren't going to make drug
that
companies
a profit?
That we
can't get funding for elsewhere.
But might make Jenny Craig a profit and Weight Watchers. It's a perfect
Avon,
mix of
whatever.
Optimism and cynicism.
It is, but you know, you think that there would be logic and reason and a motivation to sign on.
Yes.
But then you really try and get that done, and that becomes a very, very difficult challenge, as we all know, and we have tried.
Herb?
So the strategic issue of are there non-chemotherapy interventions that should start to be incorporated, that's sort of like motherhood and apple pie, common sense, yes. In fact, I don't know that you need a study in the adjuvant setting to try to improve lifestyle and diet. The suggestive data there, but on the non-colon cancer recurrence issues, coronary disease, new cancer, the impact of diet and weight control and exercise on those other health outcomes is, I think, sufficient to justify encouraging patients to get all those interventions or some intervention. That leads to the next question in my mind is the dose and schedule of the intervention optimized? It would be a shame to do a study where the intervention is not well optimized, whether it's a transfer from the in-person to computer, which causes it to not work as well. It would be a shame to have a negative study because it wasn't designed right.
Right. And we've had negative studies with dietary intervention in the past.
But looking at recurrence?
Yeah, looking at outcomes.
I don't think this intervention is that different conceptually than how we need to optimize other interventions called chemo before actually putting it into a trial. Need not be perfect. There can be second generation versions if the study's positive or a close negative, but I would try to be sure that whatever the intervention and the tools for follow-up are. I would also caution that these types of interventions which improve patient education are likely to have an interaction with chemotherapy because you're going to have patients who are going to be different in how they deal with their other toxicities as well. Whether or not diet confounds 5-FU toxicity or neuropathy may or may not be the case biologically. Patients who are more sophisticated about symptom assessment and their healthcare are likely to have a different profile on how they rate and or deal with other classic chemo interventions. All of this can be dealt with. And what I'm trying to say is I think there needs to be some optimization before you actually roll this out to a 50 to 100 or a $200 million study, no matter who pays for it.
And I want to ask you too, Charlie, what about the issue of when you start this? Does it make sense theoretically or based on the data to actually start this from day one or wait until they're finished with their chemo, for example?
I think you want to start the counseling at day one, even though they may not be able to comply perfectly during chemotherapy. You know, they're most motivated, obviously, when they're faced with the diagnosis. So I don't think you want to overlook that. The only thing I want to mention is data I didn't show, which I presented before, is aspirin. So in CLGB, aspirin and related compounds seem to have a significant benefit. And there's actually now another study in the Nurses' Health study looking at colon cancer patients finding the same benefit to a daily aspirin. In the design of any study, consideration towards aspirin, it may be, frankly, easier for people to take aspirin versus placebo than to consider a I'm not suggesting not doing physical activity and diet, but I would include that as well.
Those are my five biggies. Is wear the seatbelt, stop smoking, lose weight by exercise.
And take a baby aspirin.
And diet. And take aspirin. And take an aspirin a day.
But his data wasn't for a
and
baby
And the other
aspirin.
Group should not.
It was for much more aspirin was, than a baby.
Well, the other group just doesn't get specific counseling
Leave
to try to help them go
off,
through it.
Start smoking.
Yeah, don't take aspirin. You know, supersize the fries.
Neil?
I've got a question for Charlie. Charlie, are there any biologic data regarding these tumors in these studies that bear on the question of whether the biology of the tumors in people who exercise or have a good diet is a different biology than those who don't?
That's a great question. And so we just got an NCI grant to look at that in the tumors in 89803. So, for instance, does phospho-AKT expression in the tumors predict people who might differentially respond to being physically active? We're starting that now.
What's the link exactly between exercise and...
Well, you know, basically these are the, quote, energy balance pathways. If physical activity affects insulin and insulin-like growth factors, the downstream events fall on things like AKT and mTOR, where, in fact, there are companies developing drugs to inhibit that, but, in fact, your behavior will probably affect those factors as well. And so the question is, if somebody has phospho-AKT, where in theory activation of those energy pathways is a real player in driving the colon cancer, is that the person who might most benefit from being physical activity, that is to drive their insulin down?